From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! With the so-called Freeman in custody, we'll talk with a Montana human rights activist about the lessons learned from the 81-day standoff. If you can send one politician into cyberspace, why not send them all? We'll look at Congress and the Internet.
Well, I give the Speaker a lot of credit for making the issue of online access to Congress a priority. He hasn't led by example. Of the 139 members of the House of Representatives who have homepages on the World Wide Web, the Speaker's not among them. And so, as I sometimes point out to people, the emperor has no clothes and the Speaker has no homepage.
And a killer is loose in the USA. The INS releases the leader of Haiti's death squad. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal agents on the scene of the two latest black church burnings in the South are frustrated. James Kavanaugh of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms says the rural location of the churches in northeast Mississippi leaves authorities with no eyewitnesses. The churches, only 4 miles apart, burned within minutes of each other last night. The fires are being called extremely suspicious. They're the latest in a string of fires that have burned dozens of black churches in the last 18 months. About two dozen federal agents are to join local officials at the scene of the latest fires today. Tomorrow, we'll talk with a former FBI agent about why the Justice Department refuses to call the burnings domestic terrorism and why the FBI is not leading the investigation. After months of raising doubts about Clinton's character, Republicans hope to make inroads this week from a scathing report on the White House's handling of Whitewater matters, a second trial of Clinton supporters in Arkansas, and mounting interest in the collection of FBI files on Republicans. But Vice President Al Gore, in an unusually harsh assessment of Bob Dole, used Dole's record on tobacco interest to challenge the senator's integrity yesterday in a speech in Philadelphia. Gore was miffed about a Dole campaign statement that quoted Gore as saying in a 1992 television interview that there's no proven link between smoking and lung cancer. Gore said the Dole campaign failed to mention the vice president had attributed the assertion to scientists working for tobacco companies. The vice president, whose sister died of lung cancer, urged Dole to correct the record and accused him of being beholden to tobacco interests. He said, "Kick the habit, Senator Dole. It's not worth stinking up your reputation with the smoky stench of special interest politics and the dangerous din of dishonesty." It was surprisingly tough language aimed at a man whose record and service to the country were praised by President Clinton after Dole resigned the Senate. And it didn't stop there. The Clinton-Gore campaign circulated Philip Morris ads running in Europe that compare the hazards of smoking to drinking milk. It was a clear reference to Dole's saying last week that smoking is not good for kids, but he went on to say a lot of other things aren't good. Some would say milk's not good. Gore says Dole and the Republican National Committee accept thousands of dollars from tobacco interests. Dole's office responded with a list of Gore's connections to the tobacco industry. They include Gore's acceptance of tobacco contributions as a U.S. senator and a 1988 article in which the then presidential candidate was quoted as characterizing himself as a friend of tobacco. And a number of Supreme Court decisions came down yesterday. The Supreme Court allowed women raped and tortured in the former Yugoslavia to sue Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic in the United States for crimes against humanity. And following its decision invalidating a Colorado anti-gay law, the Supreme Court ordered review of a Cincinnati charter amendment that also denies discrimination protection to homosexuals. And the Supreme Court opened the way for possible reinstatement of a provision of Utah law that makes it harder to get abortions if the fetus could survive outside the womb. And finally, the Supreme Court agreed to decide whether Congress, through the Brady gun law, can require local law enforcement officials to check the backgrounds of prospective gun buyers. The court said it will hear the appeals of sheriffs in Montana and Arizona who say the federal law unconstitutionally requires state officials to provide enforcement. And you're listening to Democracy Now! The Federal Bureau of Investigation is celebrating its victory in Jordan, Montana, where after an 81-day standoff, members of the anti-government Freeman Group surrendered to authorities. While the FBI is basking in the kudos for preventing another tragic debacle like Ruby Ridge and Waco, some observers say the FBI again set a dangerous precedent in Montana. We now turn to Ken Toole of the Montana Human Rights Network. He's a fifth-generation Montana who has grown up on and around ranches. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ken.
morning.
Well, what are the lessons that you have learned and you are encouraging other people to learn about the 81-day standoff?
Well, I guess we see several lessons. The first is the FBI didn't engage in this problem for almost a year before it inflamed to a standoff situation. And during that time, the Freeman in Montana trained people from all over the country in their kind of wacky common law court ideas. And we're very concerned that even before the standoff started, this was allowed to go on for quite some time, and there was federal jurisdiction on a number of these people during that whole period. So the first lesson that we see out of the whole situation in Montana is that the FBI should engage more quickly when there are people breaking the law, not only the FBI, but other law enforcement agencies as well.
Why don't you go back for a second, because I don't think people quite appreciate what exactly the Freemen did. I mean, they see them as, quote, wacky. But in terms of lawbreakers, explain what their crimes are.
Well, there were quite a number of crimes. Some were passing bad checks, basically bunco schemes where they were coming up with their own phony certified money orders and passing those off. Some of their crimes were directed at tax fraud and not paying their taxes, but also in getting phony refunds back from the IRS. But I think the most serious thing, and the thing that is easily missed in this, is these guys were engaging in terrorist activity directed at people who disagreed with them and people who were charged with enforcing the law. And that ranged from, plots to kidnap local judges to filing phony liens on the local county clerk and recorder that they disagreed with about filing their documents at the local courthouse. And so there were a number of crimes that these guys engaged in with very real victims that were just classic kind of political terrorism, trying to get their way through threatening and intimidating people.
Now, Ken Toole, you've been following the Freemen for a number of years with the Montana Human Rights Network. Can you say whether this is the first time this kind of confrontation has occurred, or at least they've done these things, or is it simply the first time where the FBI has confronted them on it?
It's certainly not the first time they've done these things. This kind of behavior has been going on not only in Montana, but around the country, and it has stepped up around the country. These common law courts, as they call them, are now active in 30 states. This is definitely the first time there has been this kind of nose-to-nose, eyeball-to-eyeball standoff. But in Montana, we've had three or four instances where people who come out of this far-right belief system have had confrontations with law enforcement, but it certainly didn't. None of them played out exactly like the Freeman and Jordan did.
Now let's talk about the approach of the Clinton administration, of the FBI. I mean, clearly they did not want a repeat of Waco and Ruby Ridge, and so they chose to hold off and to negotiate using, in fact, people like the Freeman, or at least people who shared very right-wing ideologies. Can you describe who they are and how you felt about this?
Well, there's a joke going around in Montana that the FBI was trying to bring everybody who ever criticized them in any way through this compound to engage with the Freeman and see how difficult their job is. But we saw basically the top tier of the radical right in this country out in Jordan, Montana, doing a two-step for the national media. Bo Greitz, who was for a short period of time was David Duke's running mate in the Populist Party, run survivalist trainings called Spike Trainings around the country. Clearly a major figure in the far right wing. Charlie Duke, who was kind of a leader of the nascent state rights movement and a senator in Colorado, but definitely these people agree with the Freeman in their political interpretation of the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. And we're very concerned that the national leadership in the right wing, in the far right wing, use this as an opportunity to paint themselves as reasonable everyday Americans, which we believe they clearly are not.
What was the alternative of the FBI if they wanted to avoid, you know, guns blazing and moving in?
Yeah, I think that it certainly is appropriate to use, and I think you can point to a lot of other examples where you have law enforcement has brought in people who know folks in a hostage situation or whatever to negotiate. I think the problem that we had here in Montana is that there was just such a trail in and out of Jordan for, you know, Bo Greitz, Charlie Duke, Kirk Lyons, Norm Olson was there, a variety of militia people came through. It was the sheer number and almost like anybody's welcome to try their hand at this.
Explain some of the people you just mentioned, who they are.
Well, I think I've touched on Greitz and Duke. Kirk Lyons is with a foundation. He's an attorney called the Cause Foundation. And Lyons has a history of representing white supremacists, but more importantly, speaking at white supremacist gatherings, clearly sympathetic to that point of view. Norm Olson, while he was not allowed to negotiate, was certainly out there trying to stir the waters. He's the leader of the Michigan militia. There were a number of people that came up from the Texas militia. From our perspective, it was more the number, and they were from various aspects of the far right, including militia organizations.
We're talking to Ken Toole, who is a fifth-generation Montanan, and he's with the Montana Human Rights Network, has certainly been following the standoff and has been following the Freeman for a number of years. Now, when you talk about their feelings about the nation state and their feelings about their position in that, you didn't talk much about the Christian identity movement and the issue of racism, anti-Semitism. Where does that fit in? Because certainly the major media did not play that up at all.
It's central to what these folks believe in. If you look at the hate movement overall, you will see that it has a variety of wings to it, and there's a theological wing, which is Christian identity, that holds that white people are God's chosen and Jews are Satan's spawn. And then there's the political wing, in which people believe that there are different statuses of citizenship. There are what they call organics or sovereign citizens, and 14th Amendment citizens are a different kind of citizen that are delineated along racial lines. The Freeman are kind of the political manifestation. In other words, they spend all of their time talking about government and constitutional theory, but many of them are also Christian identity adherents. Central in their belief system is the idea that America is a white Christian nation, God's promised land. And that's a good example of how leaders in the far right were able to manage this situation out in Jordan. Bo Greitz, Charles Duke, a number of these guys came out saying, oh, these people aren't racist or anti-Semitic in any way, or they would say things like, I didn't see any evidence of their racism and anti-Semitism. We've been watching the documents and things they've been filing in courts for 6-7 years now, and Christian identity and racist anti-Semitic beliefs are just shot through all of those documents.
What about the cost of this standoff? The operation cost nearly $1 million a day, 81 days, around $80 million.
Yeah, we're still waiting to see the bill come in, but there's no question it was very costly. And I think one of the issues that will be interesting to watch in the future, I don't think this can become the modus operandi for bringing people into custody. It was very costly, very time-consuming, both for the federal government and the FBI, but also for the state and local governments here in Montana.
You know, I think it's interesting. In some abortion hearings in Congress, there has been suggestion that the cost of doing business for a women's health clinic should simply be that they have to hire more security, that the state is not going to take this on. I didn't hear these same Congress members complaining about the cost of the standoff.
No, it's. I think that's one of the political issues that may emerge in this over time as some final numbers come out. But there's no question the politics of dealing with the terrorism of the far right is something that I'm still scratching my head over. I think the clearest example is following Oklahoma City and the bombing. The reaction of the Congress was to hold hearings on Waco. I mean, we're still kind of scratching our heads here, and there's no question that at any time these issues elevate to the quote-unquote partisan political arena, I think they just become very unpredictable and really not very rational.
I've also heard very little from those Congress members who were involved with the Waco hearings or Ruby Ridge hearings about the trial that's going on right now in Philadelphia around the bombing of the MOVE group that happened 10 years ago.
Right. I mean, there are, I think, many examples. The one that we see or hear a lot about in Montana because of our Native American population is a comparison of the standoff in Jordan to Wounded Knee, which was, almost exact opposites in the way that the FBI went right in at Wounded Knee.
That's an example we have not heard at all in the mainstream media. What about the locals right now? I mean, some felt that the only reason the FBI came in was that the locals were actually up in arms and were going to move in on the freemen themselves and that the FBI was protecting them. How do the locals feel now with the standoff over?
Well, I think there's a huge sigh of relief out in Jordan, Montana that this whole thing is over. I think there's also a large segment of the community that feels some resentment in, number one, how long it took for the FBI to come in. And there's very little question that what brought the FBI in was the fact that the locals were about to deal with it themselves. But additionally, one of the stories that has not been emphasized in the national news is the day before the standoff was brought to a conclusion, one of the owners of the property, Dean Clark, who actually is the grandson of Edwin Clark, the kind of leader of the Freeman, who now owns the property, got a court order from a local state district court judge naming the FBI and the Freeman as defendants. It was called a writ of possession, allowing him to go onto his property and plant his crops. And the day before, four-wheel drive tractors came over the ridgetop to go and plant. It was really a confrontation between state and federal authority, and they managed to work it out because they were so close to a surrender. But I think that shows you that the local people there were getting very fed up with how long the standoff was going on.
Ken Toole, you've come out with a report called A Season of Discontent, the first publication in the country to identifying the growing threat posed by unorganized militias. How can people get a hold of that?
It's available at our office. Our address is Post Office Box 1222, Helena, Montana, 59624.
And do you have a phone number?
Yes, it's 406-442-5506.
Again?
406-442-5506. 5506.
Now, one of the things you do with the Montana Human Rights Network is you go around providing training. And this is a program that looks at grassroots activity around the country. What does it mean to provide training around right-wing militias?
Well, first of all, there is a kind of need for exposure, I guess, is the way to put it. Part of our training is explaining the difference between the public face these groups present and the internal face that they present. Obviously, in their effort to recruit, they want to appear patriotic, and benign, and not threatening. But when you look at their literature and things, it's somewhat of a different picture. And so part of our work is making sure that the community understands that this may not be a what you see is what you get. The other part of our training is working with community members. Because these groups engage in violent rhetoric and there is a history of violent activity around far-right groups, fear and intimidation occurs in a community where people stand up and oppose them. And many people just are fearful of doing that. And we work with people on issues like writing letters to the editor. What can you do? What happens if you are threatened? What are the things you can do there? Let's organize a community event and bring in a speaker who talks about democracy and pluralism. Strategies in the community to confront the anti-democratic notions that these groups promote.
Well, Ken Toole, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Ken Toole is with the Montana Human Rights Network. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to talk about the Internet and Congress. And then finally, we're going to be taking a look at Emmanuel Constant, the Haitian paramilitary leader who has just been released by the United States. This is Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. When Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich seized the reins of Congress, he spun a futuristic vision in which laptop computers would be given to poor people and the Internet would be a force for progress and even liberation. But Congress has been slow to fulfill that vision, and some will be surprised to learn that members of Congress themselves are spending very little time and money in cyberspace. An estimated 15 million people in the U.S. log on to computer networks each day, and that number is growing significantly each month. But if you try to find out what's going on Capitol Hill, or even just try to send electronic mail to your representatives, you'll probably be disappointed. Chris Casey tried to change all that when he designed the first website used by a senator while working in the office of Massachusetts Democrat Ted Kennedy 3 years ago. Now Casey has written a book called The Hill on the Net, about politicians and cyberspace. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky recently spoke with Chris Casey about his experiences trying to get Congress online.
Chris Casey, it would seem, given the level of technology available to most human beings who are plugged into the Internet, that Congress would by now be able to send us texts of bills, instantly transmit to those who want to know it how people voted, give us the full text of the congressional record the minute it comes to the government printing office. Why aren't we getting all of these things and much more?
Well, I think most people would be surprised to learn that, in fact, Congress has been a little bit slow to catch on to using new technology. I've worked in the Senate for 4 years, 3 years in Senator Kennedy's office, and 1 year with the Democratic leadership. And it's only been very recently that Congress has taken many steps to move ahead, putting itself online. The Senate, in particular, where my experience has been, is an institution that is very slow to change. It takes pride in being the greatest deliberative body in the world. There are still spittoons and fresh boxes of snuff kept on the Senate floor.
Who uses those? Have you seen anybody dip into the snuff
lately?
No,
but they're there for old time's sake, I think. And, in fact, bean soup is on the Senate menu every day. And so plugging in and getting connected to the Internet hasn't been something that the Senate or the Congress has rushed to, nor been at the leading edge of.
Nevertheless, you point out in your very informative book, The Hill on the Net, that there are some senators, and of course even more members of the House, who do want to get plugged in, and it's not a question of being a Democrat or a Republican, is it? There are people on each side of the aisle who are pro-net, and there are people who are anti-net. How do you see this breaking down? What is it? Is it generational? Is it younger members who perhaps have had computer and web experience before they come to the Congress who are more pro-net?
No, it really doesn't even necessarily break down that way. In my own experience, is an example of that. Senator Kennedy, who's been a member of the Senate for longer than I've been alive and who is not himself a computer user, instantly grasped and appreciated the idea of reaching his online constituents in Massachusetts when I made that suggestion to him. And in 1993, helped to make him one of the first members of Congress on the Internet. So you can't necessarily break it down generationally. And as you point out, it's not necessarily a partisan matter either. There are net-savvy Democrats and Republicans, and there are those who are less so or net-wary, I guess. I think I would generally divide members of Congress into three groups. There are those who have no computer or internet experience and no interest in gaining any. There are those who have at least not been able to miss the attention that new technology and the internet in particular have gained over the last couple of years and have made it a priority among their staffs to put their office online, even though they themselves might not be doing it. And there's the last but growing number of members who are actual hands-on users themselves, who send and read their own email, who would know how to surf the web. And I think it's really not going to be very long before a book like my own about The Hill on the Net will be a curiosity, just like a book called The Hill on the Phone might be. A member of Congress having an email address or a homepage on the web will be no more unique than a congressional office having a telephone or a fax machine. But it is an interesting transition period to watch as Congress goes online.
Now, I was in Washington last year for the first 100 days of Congress. We did a special Pacifica program, Julianne Malveaux and I did, called 100 Days of Congress. And during that time, I attended the press conference when Newt Gingrich announced proudly the new service called Thomas, which was to be supplied by the Library of Congress. And I remember him saying something to the effect that, why should Washington lobbyists be the only people to be able to see the full text of bills and the progress of bills and markups as they go through Congress? Why shouldn't every citizen who is computer literate be able to see this? Well, that was a grand and wonderful statement, but you point out in your book that Gingrich has not followed that up.
Well, he hasn't in a couple of senses. First of all, while Thomas is a terrific service that grants access to the record and to legislation, it really didn't put anything on the net that wasn't already available online through the government printing office or that the House itself was putting online. And so Congress became, Thomas became a new site for finding this material and I think an easier to use one. But neither has it yet lived up to the Speaker's promise that all of this information would be available online as quickly as it would be to the highest paid Washington lobbyists. In fact, there have been cases with library staff who work on Thomas where they've taken their own vacation time to get away from their day-to-day duties long enough in order to keep Thomas up to date. So Thomas has met its share of criticism. Perhaps it was overpromised. I understand that new steps are being taken to bring it up to date. But the other thing I do point out that while I give the Speaker a lot of credit for making the issue of online access to Congress a priority, he hasn't led by example. Of the 139 members of the House of Representatives who have homepages on the World Wide Web, the Speaker's not among them. And so as I sometimes point out to people, the Emperor has no clothes and the Speaker has no homepage. And I'm sure he eventually will, but for all the talk of a cyber speaker, you won't find Mr. Gingrich online.
Well, but you will find Mr. Gingrich doing something that you point out in your book, which is encouraging people, first of all, to write to him on the internet, saying what a wonderful, 21st century tool it was. And then you write about the fact that he was getting so much mail that his staff was basically shredding it in his office.
That was the story, and I heard it from more than one source, that shortly after the election, when, of course, Speaker-elect, he got a tremendous deal of attention and I'm sure a tremendous spike in his email that his staff found themselves unprepared to manage it, initially requested that it be deleted when the computer support people refused to do that. They asked first that it all be printed, and so they ended up with quite a lot of hard copy email that then was subsequently shredded. I'm sure that they've probably improved their ability to manage email. But it's a dilemma that every member of Congress faces, particularly when people who send email to their congressmen or to their senators very frequently feel that while they're at it, they may as well copy that message to every other member of Congress who has an email address.
And so then you get spamming.
Absolutely. And so from the senator's point of view, they feel like they've carried out some sort of righteous act of electronic activism here. What happens on the Hill is you have a congressional office that gets boatloads of incoming email, and finding a message that's actually from a constituent of their own can be challenging.
Well, it is, as you say, parallel to the invention of the telephone when people first realized they could call their members of Congress and then offices would be flooded with calls. And I remember just a few years ago when the fax machine came into vogue and people realized they could fax their members of Congress, and then suddenly we found that members of Congress had to have private fax numbers. Otherwise, their public fax number would be tied up all day. So it's a question of the American people really seem to want to, in many cases, communicate with their members of Congress. But every time there's a technological leap, let's say from the telephone to the fax to the internet, Congress seems to find some way of saying, hey, too much communication. I can't take it. Isn't that true?
Well, absolutely. And each new technology brings new challenges with it. What I tell members of Congress who are considering going online, there's not a question of if they're going to do this. They will go online sooner or later. It's a question of when. And I recommend to them that they familiarize themselves and their staffs with email and figure out how to deal with it, that they're going to eventually, and that they'll do better to just learn how to use it. I imagine, you know, once upon a time, someone must have been the last member of Congress to install a telephone in their office because they wanted to hold out to the last minute. And sometime along the line, they
came. It's probably Strom Thurmond. He's still there.
No, I would guess he was probably the first.
Chris Casey, let me ask you about the presidential candidates this time. One of the things I learned from reading your book, The Hill on the Net, astonishing fact, is that Bill Clinton has no website. Bob Dole does have a website, and I was fooling around in it yesterday, and I found it is really basically very nicely designed, but has nothing of any pressing content in it. I was looking to see about his trip to California, for example, and I went and found a state-by-state breakdown, news about Bob Dole, state-by-state. And I went to California, and all it was an open letter from Bob Dole to the citizens of California, which could have been written 4 years ago, and nothing whatsoever of any present context. So nobody's really maintaining that and keeping it up to date. It would seem that these two major political party candidates aren't exactly thrilled, or their staffs aren't thrilled, about the possibilities of net communication in 1996.
Well, I think you're missing one factor on that, and that is separating their campaign site versus their site as office holder. The president, of course, has the White House homepage, has not yet unveiled a campaign page. What I find interesting is that Senator Dole has a campaign page, but as majority leader has no Senate site. And I think in campaign 96, you're going to find many politicians who discover the net first as candidates when they've since ignored it as public servants. Among the four Republican senators who ran for their party's nomination for president, Dole, Graham, Lugar, and Specter, every one of them had their presidential campaign on the internet more than a year before Election Day, and yet not one of them, among them, has their Senate office online. And so I think that tells something about the perception of what the net has to offer. If as a candidate they look at it as a source of potential donations or volunteers, then perhaps in these cases they've gone online where they haven't yet seen the need to bring their offices there.
Well, what's the ultimate democratic, small d, democratic implication of this? You mention a statistic which I've seen elsewhere that 90% of the people who watch C-SPAN, for example, vote. Is there any indication of what percentage of people who are on the internet vote? And what would your guess be? Are these people who are likely to be more involved in the electoral politics system if they do participate in some sort of net activity, or don't we know yet?
No, I think the evidence is that they will. These are people who are online. They're more likely to be well-educated. They're obviously technologically savvy, and they are more likely, of course, by bringing themselves to a political site, likely to be an interested, active voter. It's one unique thing that's different about the internet than television or other campaign mediums is that it's non-intrusive. The voter has to bring themselves to the campaign site to find the information, unlike a television commercial or a radio ad or even a mass mailing that brings itself to the voter uninvited. An internet campaign site needs the voter to bring themselves there, and that's all the more reason to expect that these individuals are likely to be very interested and politically active.
Last year, I mentioned that we did this program on Pacifica called 100 Days, and we established a conference where people could write to us online, and every day on the program we mentioned our email address, and I was basically the person who got the mail and had to deal with it, and I was getting a fair amount of mail, 15, 20, sometimes 30 pieces a day. Obviously, I had other duties, so I couldn't be replying to all these people, but a lot of the things we got were useful and helpful, and the criticisms were well taken, and a lot of it was just sheer nonsense, self-indulgent raving, I think I would characterize it as, the bozos, as they say in the internet language. How much of a factor is this in impeding communication, that one or two or three or four people can get online in a chat group or whatever and really screw things up for everybody else? And what do you do about it in Congress? What did you do about it in Senator Kennedy's office, for example?
Well, particularly with the email, as you might expect, with the regular mail, the postal mail, or snail mail, Senator Kennedy is probably a member of Congress who invites quite a bit of letters that are certainly not just coming from his own constituents, and not always the most logical type of notes. I include one example in the book where we received a postcard that had a message on it that said simply, "If you vote no, I will remember you."
And it didn't even say
that,
on what.
That was all it said. Email is the same. There is a balance of people. The senator used to get quite a bit of email from college kids who were taking a break from exams and sending a note that would say, "Is this really Ted Kennedy? Wow, how are you doing?" One day, as a matter of fact, we inexplicably all of a sudden got about a half dozen email messages all coming from Sweden. And I replied to one of these gentlemen and asked why the sudden Swedish interest in the senator. And he pointed out that a Swedish computer magazine had had an article about online politics and included Kennedy's email address. And so there is quite a bit of that type of messages.
So what do you do about it?
Well, you read them, you look through them, and choose how to respond or not. Different members of Congress have different policies as to whether or not they reply to non-constituent mail. Some forward it to the appropriate representative if it's not their own. Some do respond to it, and some ignore anything but constituent letters. What members frequently do with email is they want to find a postal address in that incoming message, because an email address alone doesn't always offer them the clues that would indicate whether or not you're a constituent of theirs or not. And understandably, members are interested in being most responsive to their own constituents.
Chris Casey, quickly, as we end here, what do you see the next step being? How are we going to get more than the approximately 40% of the members of Congress that are on the web in some form, whether it's email or homepage? How are we going to get that to happen? How is it going to happen? And how are citizens going to begin to interact with it?
Well, I think what's going to happen is, as members continue to get themselves online and become more accustomed and accommodated to the net themselves, the next and more important step will be to get more congressional information online. While member homepages frequently provide very useful resources, they are understandably that member's own view of themselves, and they are PR. Most of the work that takes place in Congress is at congressional committees, hearing testimonies, transcripts, bill markups, and committee reports. And there's a tremendous amount of congressional information that's not yet widely available online, and yet needs to be. Just last week, the House Rules Committee, Subcommittee on Rules and Organization, held a hearing about technology in the 21st century and actually discussed changes in House rules that would be required to make more committee information available online.
And we'll look forward to hearing what those rules are in the future, but they certainly aren't there yet. There is information, and if you want to know where it is, you can look in Chris Casey's new book, The Hill on the Net, Congress Enters the Information Age, a thorough guide not only to his personal experiences getting Ted Kennedy's office on the net and with other senators and members of the House, but it also has lists of who is online, who isn't, who has web pages and who doesn't. The book called The Hill on the Net by Chris Casey, published by AP Professional Books, a division of Harcourt Brace. I'm Larry Bensky for Pacifica Radio.
And thank you for that, Larry. You're listening to Democracy Now! 2 years ago, President Clinton explained why the U.S. military was going into Haiti.
Cedros and his armed thugs have conducted a reign of terror, executing children, raping women, killing priests. As the dictators have grown more desperate, the atrocities have grown ever more brutal.
That was his rationale 2 years ago. This weekend, President Clinton released one of Haiti's most feared leaders of their death squads, Emmanuel Constant. We'll have more on that in a minute.
Recent news reports have documented the slaying of Haitian orphans by the nation's deadly police thugs. The dictators are said to suspect the children of harboring sympathy toward President Aristide for no other reason than he ran an orphanage in his days as a parish priest. The children fled the orphanages for the streets. Now they can't even sleep there because they're so afraid. As one young boy told a visitor, "I do not care if the police kill me because it only brings an end to my suffering." International observers uncovered a terrifying pattern of soldiers and policemen raping the wives and daughters of suspected political dissidents. Young girls, 13, 16 years old, people slain and mutilated with body parts left as warnings to terrify others. Children forced to watch as their mothers' faces are slashed with machetes.
That was President Clinton 2 years ago in September of 1994, in this dramatic explanation of why the United States military was going into Haiti. Today, we have learned that Emmanuel Constant, the leader of the dreaded Haitian military death squad, has been released here in the United States by the U.S. government. And that's our topic on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined by two guests, Michael Ratner, Center for the Constitutional Rights attorney in New York City, and we're joined by Jean Pierre, who is a Haitian journalist. He writes for The Village Voice. How is it possible that on Friday, Emmanuel Constant, who was being held in an INS detention facility in Baltimore, Maryland, was released? Now, the U.S. government says that they are waiting for the Haitian government to ensure Constant will be safe if he's deported back to Haiti. And in the meantime, they have released him here in this country. Michael Ratner, can you explain what has happened, which must come as a surprise to many people in this country?
Well, I think the U.S. explanation of waiting to be safe is nothing but an excuse. I don't think they ever wanted to send Constant back. He's been in a jail here for over 6 months. I think the explanation is fairly straightforward, which is Constant, who was the architect of many of the abuses during the coup period, was a paid agent of the CIA, a paid informant, a paid worker, and FRAP, his organization, the right-wing paramilitary organization that death squads that did many of these killings, was actually, many people believe, set up by the United States. So I think what they're really doing is taking care of someone who carried out and was on the U.S. payroll during the coup period. Has nothing at all to do with, whether he'll get a fair trial or all the excuses they're making about Haiti. It's true, what they don't want to do is they don't want to send him back because they don't want him to go to jail, and they figure they owe him something, and therefore they're going to let him loose on the streets of New York, Washington, Miami, where, if anything, he could be extremely dangerous. This is a community of progressive Haitian people, in many respects, Aristide supporters, and I just can't believe that the United States could let, contrary to law, contrary to any common sense, would let basically a killer out on the streets where he can continue to do his damage.
Jean Pierre, how many people were killed during the three-year coup in which Aristide was deposed and Emmanuel Constant, head of the FRAP, had free rein in Haiti?
Well, the figures are touted by many human rights organizations. It's 5,000 upwards. As you run at the beginning of your piece, the President Clinton so dramatically giving people a picture of the terror under which Haitians have been living during the reign of the military. What is surprising is the fact is Toto Constant. He's the man who, at least intellectually, is responsible for many or most of these killings. I do concur with Michael. The idea of leaving Constant here in the United States and New York, it's a very dangerous one for the simple reason that eventually he will blend into the population. This idea of having the immigration, and that's what I've read on AP Wire report saying that the immigration service is monitoring Constant here in Queens. It is after a few months, probably less. This is going to be relegated to the back burner, and they're not going to be bothered with Toto Constant. And I think his presence is dangerous. This is a guy who has no trade, and all he knows how to do is just to instill terror and within this the Haitian community, whether abroad. In Haiti, remember, there are many FRAP representatives here, FRAP offices here in New York and Miami and Canada. So I think it's a dangerous precedent by letting this guy out, although one might say legally, since Haiti does not have any treaty of extradition with the United States, it was just an immigration matter. But if his visa was revoked, how come they let him here in the States? That's something I'm trying to grapple with.
You know, it's interesting how the Reuters Newswire puts it. It says a warrant was issued for Constant's arrest, and he was apprehended in New York 5 months later. This is about a year ago. But the fact is that he came into this country, he was allowed in, and it was only after there was tremendous outcry, which embarrassed the Clinton administration about why he was allowed to move around freely, that the Clinton administration went after him and finally detained him. But here they have released him again. Now, Michael Ratner, at the Center for Constitutional Rights, you have filed suit against Emmanuel Constant, a civil suit. Can you explain what that's about?
Well, what we really filed was a suit against FRAP, which is the paramilitary death squad that was terrorizing Haiti during this period, of which Constant was the head. And Constant, we subpoenaed Constant in that case, took his deposition a number of times in the prison in Maryland. And so Constant is not technically a defendant, but the organization of which he is the president is a defendant. It was a lawsuit filed really on behalf of a plaintiff, Alert Balance, who maybe some of your listeners are familiar with, who was a woman in Haiti who was, they attempted to kill her, sliced off part of her arm, her face. They left her for dead in a killing field, and she eventually made her way to the United States, where we were able to sue FRAP and bring Constant in on the case. I do want to say one thing that John mentioned about the extradition business. There is actually an extradition treaty with Haiti in the United States. Haiti did make a demand for extradition, as well as, of course, he's under a deportation order. The United States said there wasn't enough evidence in the extradition request. Of course, that they could have still deported him to Haiti. But in effect, the last 6 months have been spent by a number of Haitian investigators gathering the evidence that I believe would have now been easily sufficient not only to require his extradition, which I think it did, but to try and convict him of both torture and murder in Haiti. And in the light of that evidence, I think what actually happened here, I think he may have been, it's possible he may have been on his way back a few months ago. I think at that point the United States didn't believe that there was enough evidence to really convict him other than being the head of FRAP, which might not have been alone sufficient. I think the investigators in Haiti then got sufficient evidence of two particular incidents, a fire in City Soleil that he was involved in setting that killed a number of people, and a particular instance in which he was present while a person was tortured. I think once we had those two cases built up against Constant, they realize that if he goes back to Haiti, he's going to jail for a very long time.
And we should remind people what Cité Soleil is, one of the poorest areas of Haiti, a slum in Port-au-Prince, where many of Aristide's staunchest supporters were. And it was in December of 1993 that a whole area of Cité Soleil was torched by FRAP supporters. And it sounds like what you're saying, and in talking to an investigator earlier today, they have evidence that links Emmanuel Constant to the scene of that crime.
That's correct. Evidence of him directing that crime as it was going forward, directing the burning. And I think that once we establish that evidence, that basically the United States made a decision that said we're not sending him back. And sadly, very sadly, I mean, as Jean-Jean and I have both said, it's a complete outrage, but it's consistent with the U.S. position with regard to these very serious human rights violators and violations. They have been unwilling, essentially, to lift a finger to help the Haitian government in prosecuting either Constant or in anybody else. And I guess the documents come to my mind when I think of that, the 150,000 pages of documents that line by line document who did the abuses to whom during that three-year period. The U.S. seized them during the invasion. It is now holding them and has been unwilling to give them over to the Haitian government, documents that would be crucial in finally uprooting a system of violence in Haiti that has gone on for 100 years.
You know, I just want to describe the scene for people. For those of you who remember watching CNN and other networks, when the U.S. troops moved in, one of the most dramatic scenes was them moving into FRAP headquarters, the paramilitary headquarters in downtown Port-au-Prince, as well as FOD headquarters, that's the Haitian military headquarters, and taking out low-level FRAP members, for example, from the FRAP headquarters, taping their mouths, binding their hands, and saying this was the beginning of bringing justice and law and order to Haiti. Well, at the same time, and what the cameras weren't catching were the soldiers bringing out boxes of these documents. Now, in the next few days, these FRAP members were all released, but the documents never were. And although, in fact, I was there last year and talked to the embassy spokesperson about whether they would release these documents, he said, yes, we are releasing them. We're in negotiation with Aristide when he was president at the time. In fact, they haven't been released. Is that right, Michael?
That's correct. They have not been. They're willing to release the documents only in what we call in legal terms redacted form, which means with a lot of the names erased and a lot of information erased. Haiti correctly has said there are documents, there are papers, and we want the full set of documents so that we can pursue justice in our country. So here you have the United States, not only with the release of Toto Constant, but with the documents in a number of other ways, basically impeding any serious investigation into the killers that ruled Haiti for the 3 years.
Jean-Pierre, are we seeing U.S. electoral politics being played out on the Haitian stage? I mean, on the one hand, you have President Clinton not wanting Constant to return because of what would be exposed with his relationship with the U.S. CIA. And we don't see Senate Majority Leader or former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, who, while he was Majority Leader, sent down a delegation to Haiti to investigate what the investigators were investigating. And he was not calling for the return of Emmanuel Constant.
Well, I think you're right, but it goes beyond U.S. Electoral politics, at least for 1996. I think at the heart of this is the practice of the CIA by using proxies in Haiti to do the dirty work of this low-intensity warfare that has been institutionalized by the United States since in the wake of the Second World War. And I think it is a pattern that we see still unfolding in Haiti. So, President Clinton is not really interested in getting Constant back for the simple reason the CIA was involved. But the Pentagon, I think, probably would have more to lose, more so than the White House, by having Constant back to Haiti. And you're so right by mentioning Bob Dole. Yes, the delegation went to Haiti, issued a report, a scalding report on the Clinton administration. But I think they all, if not explicitly, but at least tacitly agreed that the bottom line is to keep Haiti where it is, or even a worse state, by not doing anything to bring justice to the Haitian people. I spoke to President Préval on my last trip to Haiti for The Voice, and he told me that he's pursuing the getting of the documents, but he's still confronted by this hurdle put by the U.S. This idea of redacting, that is taking off all the names of American nationals, and we're talking about American nationals, not just American soldiers. We're talking about people who were part of FRAP, who were naturalized citizens. So, I don't think either Bob Dole or President Clinton is interested in getting a constant back to Haiti. I think the only hope now is the Center for Constitutional Rights to at least pursue him in the civil suit on behalf of Alain Berland, because I don't think politically this is we're going to see any end to it soon.
Michael, maybe you could explain what the U.S. interests in Haiti are right now. I mean, you have the president, René Préval, following through very much on the U.S.'s neoliberal plan there, opening Haiti up to U.S. investment, corporate investment like Disney, making their Pocahontas pajamas there, paying less than the minimum wage, etc. But you also have them stepping in the way of any kind of justice to clear the way for a healthy society.
Well, I think it's a very, very narrow interest. It's one that wants to see privatization of certain industries. And when I say privatization, whether it's the flour mill or the electric company or the telephone company, it's really a privatization that essentially transfers those assets to Americans and others who are going to bid on them. So it's a very, very narrow interest, which is essentially a capitalist interest of transferring money from basically the people of the country into private hands. It's not an interest in seeing the overall health of Haiti. It's an interest really in a few people benefiting from the wealth of Haiti.
In fact, aren't those people who are benefiting, many of those are the supporters of the coup.
Well,
and
that's
people
right.
Like
I mean,
Cedrus
who else,
and Constant.
Let's look at who really invests in Haiti and who buys. It's the elites who run the country and probably a few outsiders. And so it's really going to be continuing to put economic power in the hands of the very elites that ran the coup. And while some political power is now in the hands of the people or in the masses of Haiti, essentially the country is still run economically by the same people who ran the coup. So you're not going to get a real change in Haiti, I believe, until that economic situation has changed. And the United States, obviously, is by its privatization policies as well as by keeping these documents that will show us who in the elites ran the coup, will be continuing Haiti to have the same economic base that it's had for a long time in the elites and having no real change for the masses of people in Haiti. It's a very, very sad situation.
Former President Aristide just met with President Clinton yesterday. Do you know if he raised the issue of Emmanuel Constant's release just 2 days before?
I don't know. I haven't spoken to his office today. I'm hopeful he did, because I'm sure it was the case that when I worked with President Aristide, that we worked very hard on. He was obviously a crucial person. I spent a lot of time in Maryland with one of the other counsel for Haiti, trying to get it Constant and figure it out. And it was really a high priority of his. I am sure he is very, very upset that Emmanuel Constant is allowed to stay in the United States.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Jean-Jean Pierre of the Village Voice, Haitian-American reporter, and I also want to thank Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. As we learn at this hour in the last few days that Emmanuel Constant, the leader of the dreaded FRAP, the paramilitary organization responsible for thousands of deaths, has been released in the United States. FRAP has been in some ways vindicated because he has been released. He's not been sent back to Haiti, as those tens of thousands of pages of documents that show the link between the U.S. and Haiti have also not been sent back to Haiti. We'll continue on this story on another day. Right now, we are wrapping up Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Was produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. To leave a comment on our comment line, call 202-588-0988, extension 313. That's 202-588-0988, extension 313. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at the FBI FBI files, and we'll look at the burnings of the churches with a former FBI agent. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.